Welcome back to the Movie Bible Podcast. This week, you've got myself, Colin, and I'm joined by Nick as we break down the opening weekend for Charlie's Angels, Ford vs. Ferrari, and The Good Liar. Remember, as always, you can check us out online at moviebabblereviews.com. All right, so breaking down this weekend's top five at the box office, we have Ford v. Ferrari opening up with $31.037 million domestically, followed by Midway in its second week at $8.7 million domestically. Charlie's Angels opens in the number three spot with $8.6 million domestically. Playing with Fire also in its second week at $8.55 million domestically. And Last Christmas rounds out the top five with $6.7 million domestically. So Ford v Ferrari is exceeding expectations just in terms of how much it grossed this weekend, which again was $31 million and some change. However, it does have nearly a $100 million budget. It's sitting at about $97.6 million for the budget, which is pretty large for a movie like this. And so while it is making more money than expected, it is still falling fairly short of profitable, just because you have to consider marketing costs, which are typically about the cost of the budget as well. And I know this was marketed extremely thoroughly. So it's sitting at about $52 million worldwide. But it's against a pretty big budget, and with the theater getting even more crowded in the weeks to come, I think despite the success it's had so far, Ford v Ferrari's got quite the uphill battle in front of it.
Yeah, I would definitely agree there. I walked out of this movie, and I really liked it, and I think we'll get to that in a second. But I was like, oh, this movie probably costs like $60, $65 million. And then I looked at the numbers afterwards, and like you said, it was $100 million. I was like, holy shit, like this was like a terrible like decision by Fox. Like, what were they thinking? But I was really happy to see that the movie was well ahead of expectations, because I think in the middle of the week it was tracking to something like 20, 25 million, which is like kind of like a death sentence for a movie with such a high budget. But I think on the other side of kind of what you mentioned before with the holidays coming up, I mean, we see a lot of movies do really, really well in the holiday season, and they kind of have really solid week-to-week drops. And I think Ford v Ferrari is good enough where I think a lot of it's going to keep dragging in a lot of the older crowd, and they're going to keep seeing it multiple times. And I think this movie is just really fun, which might help it translate to younger audiences as well. But I think one of the more interesting things is I think that this movie is actually a sneaky good international play, considering that the Le Mans race with this, which this movie is centered around, is just a really big deal in Europe. And the movie is literally named Le Mans 66 everywhere else except the United States, because us ugly Americans don't care about Le Mans. So I think this movie, Like with all things, the legs are really important here. But I think we should see that this movie, I think next weekend is going to be like the deciding factor on whether or not this becomes a hit, or and if it becomes like the one like kind of crowd-pleasing Oscar contender. Because I definitely think that Fox is going to gear up for some sort of push in that respect. But I think if we see this movie come out with maybe like a 40% drop next week or something around there, then I think that we should be in for some smooth sailing leading forward. But I don't really know. There's, like you said, there's a lot of work to be done here.
Yeah, and one of the best things that this has going for it is the reception it's had so far. So it's got an A+ cinema score, which is phenomenal and pretty hard to achieve. And I mean, it's just gotten rave reviews everywhere else. Everyone that sees it has typically loved it, especially as an American. You just see it and you're like, hell yeah, America, at the end of the movie. And so I think that'll help carry it domestically. And then kind of like you said, overseas, I think this is targeted pretty heavily towards the European market, just because it deals with a lot of things that are familiar to the European culture and, you know, even European nostalgia. And so I think it's definitely got some wiggle room. You know, it's not an outright failure and outright flop, but it just has to work a little harder than, you know, it could have if it had even a 25% smaller budget. I think if they had budgeted this around 50 million, Yeah, you would have had to cut some corners when it comes to the larger set pieces in the movie, but I think it would have been poised to be a really big hit at a much smaller budget.
Yeah, but it is one of those things too. It's like that extra budget, like you can see it in some of these racing sequences because they're just unbelievable. Like the racing in this movie is so, so cool. And like, I got a tip of the cap to James Mangold for directing them in such a way. Like it is so propulsive and fun, and just there's so much, they're just really thrilling. And on top of that, you have Christian Bale just having a blast for what seems like the first time and maybe like forever. Like, I can't really think of the last time that he wasn't some darkly serious or brooding like lead character. Like he's just having a grand old time, and Matt Damon's there too, also having a grand old time. Like this is one of those movies where, I mean, yeah, you kind of mentioned before that it's like America, fuck yeah, but like when you really think about it, like the villain of the movie is like Ford in that sense. So there's a lot of talk about creativity and kind of working within, kind of, you can even extend the conversation to working within the studio system in Hollywood, which is, I think, is really interesting. But at the same time, like, it's so fun, you know, like, and it has so many great performances that are like, anyone can kind of get something out of this movie, you know, where if you're really into action, there's some crazy good car stuff in here. And for car nuts, there's just also great car stuff. And then you have Matt Damon and Christian Bale having fun. And Bernthal's in there too, putting in his shots with a really fun supporting performance. Like there's just, it's like you said, it's just a lot of fun. It's just a really good time at the theaters. I think the movie's like 2.5 hours long, but it feels like closer to two. It really moves by really solidly. I'm hoping for the best for this movie. I think there's so much fun stuff in it. Like if I wasn't seeing like 50,000 movies, I would definitely go see this movie a couple times in theaters. But yeah, really, really fun.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot going for this movie. And as someone who doesn't really care about cars or racing, I was completely into everything they were doing when it came to cars and racing in this movie.
Absolutely.
Which I think is just a testament to just how good of a movie it is. You know, it's, I don't think it really treads anything that's just super new or unique, but it does a lot of things really, really well. And I think that's really what makes it work. And just, sorry for the terrible analogy, but it's firing on all cylinders. And it's just, it's a very entertaining dive into just this kind of little unknown snippet of car history and of racing history that, you know, if you're not a huge racing fan stateside, you're probably not aware of. And if you're not familiar with Le Mans, you're probably not aware of as well. So I think it really succeeds in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I knew nothing about Le Mans before watching this movie. Like I knew that it existed, but I had no idea that it was a 24-hour race and like kind of what all of the things were going into it and everything. So I knew nothing of the story either. I was actually talking to my grandfather, and it kind of showed how good this movie was at marketing towards its key demographic, where he was like, "Oh, I can't wait to see this. This is going to be the greatest thing ever." It was really funny to hear him talk about that. But yeah, this movie just, it made me nostalgic for like a time when you could have just put two really like hot stars in front of the camera, and just, they can just be movie stars for 2+ hours, and the movie does really well and it's really fun. Because I mean, I heard James Mangold was kind of making the rounds this week on all the podcasts and all the media circles, and he was just really like thankful to have been able to make this movie. Because yeah, like it's, I mean, I feel like we say this every time a movie kind of like this comes out, but you don't get a bigger budget movie that's kind of just a good hang, you know, that it doesn't really, it's not based on any property or anything like that. Like this movie is really an outlier, and I'm curious if 20th Century Fox didn't know that the Disney purchase was coming down the pipeline, that if they would have greenlit this at all. But I don't know, I'm just really thankful this movie exists because it's really fun.
Yeah, it's been pretty bright note, and I'd say overall most of our big budget movies this year haven't been that great just in terms of the quality of the movie. And it's nice to see something that is good, but that also looks like they pumped a bunch of money into it and made it as snappy and gave it as nice of a coat of paint as they could.
Yeah, and it's this is a really awesome big screen experience, because what we've been alluding to before is just the racing sequence. It's like the last 40 minutes of this movie is the Le Mans race, and it's just unbelievable. And it just keeps going, and it keeps finding new ways to just continue to be thrilling. And it kind of like places all of these strands in there where things could go wrong, and you know exactly, like, you're on the edge of your seat, like waiting for something to go wrong, or see if Christian Bale's character pulls it out or anything like that. It's really excellently crafted, and I just keep coming back to it. I'm really thankful this movie exists, and I hope people go to see it next week as well, because it definitely deserves everything that comes its way.
Yeah, it breaks the John Bernthal tradition of only being in like 5 minutes of a movie. Except for after the second act, he really doesn't talk at all. Like, he's there, but I think he says maybe a sentence in the last hour and a half of the movie. So it still quasi counts as part of that genre.
Yeah, it's been what? It's been like four or five movies. We had Peanut Butter Falcon early this year. We had Baby Driver in there. Wind River as well. Widows too. Like, it's like, that's just kind of his thing. Like, he just shows up and stuff. But yeah, it was really fun to just kind of see him in a role where he could like do things for once. Like, I don't think he has a single line of dialogue in the Peanut Butter Falcon. Like, he just shows up in flashbacks. So, and it was just like, this movie is just, it's a really good, just showcase for just really fun actors being able to play it up and have a lot of fun banter. It's a throwback in a lot of ways. It's just really great. And I feel like Matt Damon is kind of like low-key one of the better, just like one of the better like movie stars we have, because he just always seems to pick really solid or at least just interesting projects to get involved in. And he's like one of the few that, I mean, he's had some great cameos in Deadpool and Thor Ragnarok, but he's like one of the few that hasn't been heavily involved in kind of the Marvel or DC machine. So I tip my cap to him as well, because he seems to keep getting in on really cool projects.
Yeah, and he latches on to things that have a lot of buzz with him too. So, I mean, like, his biggest movie in the past few years was The Martian. But he just finds these projects that are, like you said, interesting, and typically are almost on that kind of Marvel DC blockbustery level, but not quite. And I think that's really where he thrives.
Yeah, and like, there's been some really bad ones. Like, I think like Suburbicon, which came out a few years ago, just does not work at all. But it's a really interesting idea and a really fun concept, but it just really does not come together. And you had something last year, or maybe 2 years ago, I can't remember at this point, but with Downsizing, which, once again, I mean, he's paired with Alexander Payne in that movie, so, and there's a great premise of him just shrinking, but I think that movie was just kind of just different from what people expected it to be. It's actually, I feel like I've heard people kind of like reclaim it as kind of already like have some type of cult status. But yeah, he's just really good. He is a really good picker. So like, in theory, like, all these movies have like a really good chance of working. Some don't, obviously, but yeah, this is just another example. He just knows when to get in on the right things, and he's just stayed relevant for so long. He just shows up in all these things, and just, we're always just like, oh yeah, Matt Damon, I really like him. He's really fun in all his movies. And yeah, it just, I don't see that discontinuing anytime soon.
Yeah, we will have to excuse The Great Wall, though. That's,
oh, that's true. We'll
skip over that one.
I'm sorry. I take back everything I said. Oh, no.
So, yeah, that's Ford v. Ferrari. The real test for it will be here in the next few weeks, just as we get really crowded next week with quite a few new releases. And as we head into December, I think that's going to help it with a little bit more extra time off for most people. Hopefully time to go catch a pretty interesting and unique movie. And so it's definitely got some work to do, but it's not out yet. So that moves us along to Midway, which is in its second week at the box office. Last week it was in the number one spot. This week it's in the number two spot with just a little bit over $8.75 million domestically, and is sitting at $53.75 million worldwide. But it, kind of like Ford v. Ferrari, is against a budget that is currently crushing it. So while it has had some success and led the weekend as kind of a surprise last weekend, it still is just falling short. You know, it's got a $100 million budget. It's sitting at, you know, a little bit over $53 million worldwide. And this is its second week. I think Midway is going to end up being one of the larger flops we see this year.
Yeah, it's not doing great. And so it had actually a pretty smart release strategy last week, just with releasing and ahead of Veterans Day, which is, this is smart for a war movie to get ahead of that. But yeah, this movie had 8.8 million. It's above a 50% drop for its second week. So it seems like everyone who was interested in seeing it saw it, and that was, it's kind of it. I think this movie's gonna be one of those movies that does not succeed with the holiday bump. It feels like it's really tough because I feel like this movie was released like probably way too closely to 1917, which is, just another war movie. It's just a lot of cannibalization going on there. And I feel like you watch the trailer and it's just like, oh yeah, 1917 is probably going to be the better movie. And that movie is probably going to be a big time like awards contender. And then you have talk of it's probably going to be a one shot movie and all that. Like, I just feel like that's just everyone just probably saving their money for that if they're interested in war movies at all. Like, yeah, this movie is just, it was probably just a dumb decision to give Roland Emmerich a lot of money again after doing things like Independence Day 2 and, I don't know, 2012. And just, yeah, like, he probably needs to not have a lot of money again for his next directing gig.
Yeah, he's had a rough few years. And I think it's just his movies are really a product of the 90s, and he's never really seemed to move on from that big disaster explosion kind of style that really worked in 1996 and hasn't really worked ever since then. And I think Midway is just further evidence of that.
Yeah, just no one really cares about Roland Emmerich anymore. It's kind of a bummer. He seems like a nice guy, but yeah, it's just Midway is just is just a clunker. There's really not much else to look at it.
So yeah, that's basically all there is to say about Midway. So we will move on to Charlie's Angels, which opened in the number three spot at $8.6 million domestically. This is the reboot, of course, of the reboot of the TV show. And it's sitting at about $27.9 million worldwide, which, you know, isn't terribly shabby. But I think, actually, I don't think, I know they were hoping for a much higher return than this. And I mean, I have no doubt this was supposed to be the new launch of a rejuvenated Charlie's Angels franchise, but sitting at a budget of anywhere around $55 million, Charlie's Angels has got quite a bit of work to do as well.
Yeah, has anyone even thought about Charlie's Angels since like the early 2000s? Like, I just don't think anyone really cared anymore. Like, that brand name just has like no cachet amongst like anyone under like 40. Like, when I saw Sony was releasing this, I was just like, oh, okay, Sony's just scraping the bottom of the barrel looking for another franchise. I couldn't look at it as anything but that cynical business choice. But yeah, so I just kind of expected this movie not to do great. And it kind of, I feel like it even went below my expectations. Like, I figured this movie might do something like in the teens somewhere where it's kind of not great, but it's like not the worst thing ever. But yeah, like 8.6 for its opening in the States is just not good. You're not going to start any new franchises with that. I think this movie is probably just destined to be like a good cable movie, like within like 2 or 3 years, whenever it gets on like TNT or whatever. And you're doing the dishes on like a Saturday afternoon, and you're just kind of on in the background. I don't see any other possibility for this movie. It's just kind of fine. You know, it's very watchable. That's kind of really all it is.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's really talked about Charlie's Angels since Farrah Fawcett died in 2009. She was the last reason anybody had to talk about it. And it just, yeah, this movie just feels really clunky and weird, and it's 75% exposition. And there are some fun set pieces and some fun action scenes, but I think like the most fun they could have had with this was at the horse race scene, which you see in some of the trailers. And I mean, they cut that way short. And after that, I was like, what's the point of this movie? You just wasted the most interesting action set piece you had in the movie.
yeah, it's, it feels like, yeah, it just, this entire script feels like it's half-baked. Because, like, within the first, like, in the first scene, there's a, there's, like, the opening preamble with Kristen Stewart, and they're talking to this guy over dinner, and they beat him up, and then the credits start or whatever. And then after that, we see Naomi Scott show up, and she goes to her her superior's office in her office building, and she's like, oh, we've created this machine that will revolutionize the power industry. And it's just like, oh, okay, so you're presenting us with MacGuffin. Like, it's just the most standard, like, oh, well, we have this thing that might be weaponized. This is bad news. And then bad business guy being like, ah, don't worry about it, it's fine. It's like, but obviously that'll go into the wrong hands at some point. We'll have a movie that might, and we have things that might end the world and yada, yada, yada. Then we have the movie over and that kind of thing. So yeah, it's just very bland script. That's kind of just like kept together by like nothing like more than like chewing gum. It's just nothing there. Like, it's all the fun you get out of this movie is from the cast, which I will say is actually just really fun. They're definitely all above this material. Especially Kristen Stewart, who's just like doing whatever she can to get a laugh. Like, you can really tell that like all of her like laugh lines were kind of just her just on the fly doing something. But yeah, other than that, like, I just don't really get a lot out of this movie. Like, we were talking before we came on here that we were just talking about the movie, and I just totally forgot like one of like a big like reveal at the end of it. Like, I saw this movie like 24 hours ago, and I just like don't remember anything. So yeah, it's like this movie is just gonna come. It came and now it's gonna go without anyone really like looking at it at all. So yeah, sorry, Charlie's Angels.
Yeah, even the plot just feels very 2000s. Like you said, the bad guy wants to get this really vague electronic device that basically does whatever the movie wants it to and can kill people sometimes, but can also power everything, sort of. And it just falls apart from there. I mean, you don't really have a very well-developed villain or any really well-developed heroes. And just so much of the dialogue is exposition and people explaining things to you and explaining things to each other and then explaining things to each other again. And it really wasted its potential. And you see parts of it where they're trying to make social commentary, or they think they're being really clever about some statement they're making. Like, they try to tackle sexism in the workplace with Naomi Scott and her boss, and it just comes off as really unnatural and awkward. And there are just so few things about this movie that work.
Yeah, it's definitely like kind of like a studio product. Like, I feel like there's definitely some interesting things to play with in that sense, where like the Charlie's Angels movies in the 2000s were like the ultimate, like, oh, let's put three really attractive women together and like men can just like stare at them while they do like sexy spy stuff. But like, so, and I feel like there's something interesting to like reclaim like this property as some sort of feminist work. But I just don't think Elizabeth Banks, like, her writing isn't like great enough to accomplish that. Like, I think her direction is actually pretty good in this movie. Like, it's pretty slick and there's a lot of fun action set pieces, and the action's like pretty reasonably shot. But like, yeah, like the writing is just not good enough for to have any type of statement land. And it just feels like what it is. It just feels like a starter for another franchise in Hollywood. But it's, as we've seen with Sony, it just doesn't really work unless it's like Jumanji. That's really about it.
Yeah, I mean, I really like the creative team behind this, and I think when they're on screen with each other and they're allowed to have fun, it's fun. But there's so few moments of that it just kind of falls apart everywhere else. And that is Charlie's Angels for probably the last time.
Definitely the last time.
So we'll touch base with Playing with Fire, which is in its second week, actually expanded just a little bit to 60 additional theaters and pulled in not a huge sum, but pulled in $8.55 million domestically and is sitting at around $25 million worldwide, actually $29 million worldwide, once you throw in the international gross as well. And it's made money, but it's sitting right about its budget right now. That's not counting marketing costs. And so Playing with Fire isn't outright a flop, but it's definitely not a success at this point either.
Yeah, it's it's really, I compare this a lot to Instant Family from last year, which, I mean, there's a lot of parallels where it's, they're both Paramount movies and they both released a little before Thanksgiving and they're in, like, incredibly family friendly, where they're just, they're trying to get ahead of like the massive wave of movies that come out around Thanksgiving and then just kind of keep peppering in just like really small but really solid weekends. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing with Playing with Fire, because it's like it dropped like 33% this week. So that's a really, really good hold. And so if you have like a couple of those in a row, like it just keeps getting like these little solid grosses every week, like you're going to make your money back on it. And I think that's exactly what Paramount was trying to do here. It's not going to do anything incredible, but and even Innocent Family was actually like a weirdly like big hit last year. I don't think it's going to do anything like that, but I think we might see this movie just kind of hang around and like we'll be scratching our heads like, why are people going to see this movie? But it's striking a chord with some people, because yeah, that 33% drop is nothing to scoff at.
Yeah, and I mean, its biggest test will be this coming week with Frozen 2, and just as we move into the Christmas season, it'll have a little bit more family-friendly competition. But yeah, it's at a weird point where it's not a failure, because it's made back its production budget at this point. It really just needs to make back whatever they spend on marketing, and then everything else is, well, basically everything else is profit. So it's really this next week and the week after that'll determine whether or not Playing with Fire really succeeds at all.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, if we want to even pivot towards Last Christmas, because I don't think either of us really have much to say about this movie, other than it's kind of like the same thing with Last Christmas as it was with Playing with Fire, where it's kind of a holiday-centered movie where it's trying to get ahead of all of like the big movies that are coming down later, and it's, I mean, like Playing with Fire, Last Christmas also had a pretty decent drop this week. It was below 50%. So, I mean, I think you guys talked about it last week on the pod, but like its early November release is kind of silly. I mean, we've seen other Christmas movies release, in the beginning of November. I think the animated version of The Grinch did the same thing last year, but that was just a bigger movie. So it got to last like until Christmas, which I don't think, Last Christmas will be able to do just cause it's not on the same size, but it's doing okay. You know, like it's same thing. It's just peppering away these solid grosses week by week, and I think it's kind of the same thing where it's just gonna, we're gonna see what's gonna happen over the next week or two, and that's gonna kind of just give us everything we need to know about how this movie, if this movie's gonna be profitable or not. So yeah, Playing with Fire and Last Christmas are kind of on each other's turf in that sense, so yeah, they should be probably watched like at the same or kind of like similarly.
Yeah, and I mean, Last Christmas has made its budget back, just barely. It's sitting at a little over $35.6 million worldwide against an estimate of a $30 million budget. So it is just in a slightly better position, and I think it'll hold on a little bit better as we get really heavily into the Christmas season. But whether or not it actually holds on to Christmas is kind of anybody's game at this point, because it's still got over a month to go, and it's already, you know, in its second week dropping a little bit, coming up against heavy competition just in terms of all these new releases coming out.
Yeah, it's definitely going to lose a ton of theaters this week, because we just have a bunch of movies coming out just this week and next week. But if it can just kind of stick around and keep getting somewhere around 6 million or 5 million a week, like that's kind of all it's ever going to ask for. Like this movie was never going to be anything huge. So I don't know. We'll see. I think there's definitely some room for it to make some money left.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And that rounds up the top five. Probably the last time we'll be talking about some of these movies, but we will move on to another new release this week, which was The Good Liar, which opened at $5.656 million domestically. So not high enough to crack the top five, but this is a much smaller movie just in terms of its audience. And I mean, just in terms of the movie itself. So it's definitely not going to be anything as huge as these other movies are, but it's made a decent amount of money. It's an old person movie, so it's probably going to have better legs than the typical movie. Its budget is only $10 million, so it doesn't have a ton of uphill work to do. And it's off to a decent start. It's sitting at about $9.6 million worldwide. So it's basically made back its budget in this first weekend. And everything else on top of that will basically be profit for it.
Yeah, this movie is so fucking weird. I think we'll get to that in a second. But I wonder if... I feel like this movie has a chance to be the like the what the fuck movie of the fall. Because it is so strange. And like it's a thriller and it has all these twists and... Like the twists, it doesn't really earn them because it's just like withholding information from you until it has to like, oh, here's this dump of knowledge that just makes this movie insane. So I'm really interested. I'm wondering if this movie has decent legs at all and people kind of like discover it as kind of like the like this like holy shit, like what is this movie? Because it is so weird. And I know you were really excited to see it as well. You were weirdly interested in it. But yeah, I can't get over this. I would love to do like a 2-hour spoiler pod on The Good Liar if we could have some type of audience for it, because it is so insane.
Yeah, I was really weirdly invested in this movie for the past like 2 months or so. It's just like I'm not even really a big fan of most of the people behind it, except for Ian McKellen. But the trailer just did it for me. And I was like, I want to see that. Like, I want to know what's up. And it's definitely a mess of a movie. I went in with a much higher opinion of it than I went out with. But I still think it's very watchable. It's very enjoyable. Like there's you pretty much see the big twist coming from pretty early on in the movie, and they do just like throw in a lot of stuff at the end. You're like, wait, that's what this movie is about? But it works weirdly, and it's a chaotic but entertaining mess.
Yeah, it is so watchable. I don't know if I can call it like good, like quote unquote, but it's like really, really fun just to sit there and like, yeah, like the twist, like the baseline of the twist, you can kind of guess like very, very early on. But then like it also reveals so much more information and like so much background where you're like, what the fuck is this? like you, it's like one of those twists where you never would have guessed, but just because the movie is just like deliberately withholding information from you. Just so when it does happen, when the big one happens, it is just the most incredible, like, which is a wild thing. And I was just sitting there in the theaters, like, just like kind of laughing, and all like the old people around me, like I was the only one in my theater below was 65, and all of them just kind of like stared at me while I was snickering. It was so bizarre. It's very strange too, because I feel like this is like one of like the first movies in a while where like Helen Mirren and Ian McKellen have like been able to like just like act. Like I feel like. Like Helen Mirren has been on the record saying how she loves the Fast and the Furious movies because she doesn't even like have to act. Like she just shows up for like a day and like puts in all her work and then she's done. And then like Ian McKellen's like gonna be in Cats like in December. like it's like the first time in a while where they've just got to like been able to like just be themselves. And it's like centered around like this bizarre script. It's so strange. It's so strange.
Yeah, I think the best way to put it is like you can tell what of the twist is, but you don't really know the why until they just throw a bunch of stuff at you in rapid succession, and you're just completely confused by just how like out of left field it comes. But you're also like really intrigued, and everything is just tense because there's like murders and scams going on, and it weirdly works even if it doesn't work very well.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to ruin it here because I think people will find some benefit in like actually watching it and seeing like what happens in this movie if they ever stumble upon it. But yeah, I can't, like I said, I don't know if it's good, but it's just really weird and wacky and just kind of, it's just so funny in a way. Like I just like, I was overwhelmed with laughter at the end. Like it goes to such like lengths to show how like intricate its twists are when it's really not. It's pretty underwritten, but it is, yeah, it's very wild. That's a ringing endorsement for The Good Liar. It's insane.
Yeah, I don't think it's one of the best films of 2019, but it's definitely one of my favorite films of 2019.
Yeah, fuck you, Irishman. This is real cinema here. The Good Liar is what it's all about.
Scorsese wishes he could make this. So with that, we will move on to probably the biggest thing that dropped over this past week, which was Disney Plus, which we talked about it a little bit last week, just curiosity as to what kind of dent it would make in the overall box office. I think it probably made a considerable dent. I mean, there's nothing, we don't really have metrics to gauge that with, because streaming companies don't like sharing their numbers, but it's big. I mean, they reported over 10 million people had signed up in the first day. And so who knows what they were watching. They did release a couple new movies, the Noel movie starring Anna Kendrick and Bill Hader, and then the live action adaptation of Lady and the Tramp, which is the fifth Disney live action remake this year. And so Disney is continuing just to completely flex on everybody with how much they can do.
Yeah, it's, I think Disney's stock was on an all-time high of when it was released earlier this week. And it's like the one brand in Hollywood where just the most casual of film watchers would be like, oh, it's a Disney thing, I'm gonna buy this, you know, and like all the parks and whatnot. So this is just like the next big step and like where all these streaming companies are headed. I mean, like, I know next year we're gonna have HBO Max, which should be a big deal, and then it's like whatever NBC is doing, I think it's called Peacock, which is just, that's probably my leader in the clubhouse for one that's going to fail immediately. It's just like, yeah, Disney Plus, it's a big deal. I mean, people reported some bugs and whatnot when it first released, which is probably to be expected. I'm sure those things will get ironed out. But this is a big play, and I'm sure they're gonna get all of their properties back from Netflix once those contracts lapse and whatnot. So they'll get all the Marvel things back and everything. I'm really interested to see what happens here. I watched the new Lady and the Tramp. Unfortunately, it's just not good. It's kind of like the worst of what we've seen from these live action movies, where it's just the thing you like again, but not nearly as good or anything interesting in it. So I'm very interested to see what they do with their original programming, because I still need to watch The Mandalorian. I got to thank Uncle Disney for sending me a few screeners there, so I don't have to sign up for Disney Plus. But it's really interesting because they have an incredible library of stuff. They have just unrivaled amount of stuff. But I'm really interested to see what they do moving forward and how people ultimately receive The Mandalorian and all their original stuff, because I think that's what's going to push it into the future, in my estimation.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing to see will be how this impacts the Disney vault. So with all of Disney's, at least their animated features, and, you know, other than a lot of the like Marvel and franchise features, all of their classic features from, you know, like all the Kurt Russell films and Don Knotts and all that have always been in the Disney vault, where they rotate everything on like a 7 to 10 year cycle. So you take like Sleeping Beauty, for instance, which was just released on Blu-ray and DVD again last month, had been in the vault for like 6 years. So that means for the past 6 years, you really haven't been able to buy that. But now everything except for one Disney animated feature, which I don't know why they omitted Make My Music, but they did. But every other Disney animated feature is available right now on Disney Plus. And so I'm interested to see how they'll manage that, because I think part of what keeps their legacy and keeps all these movies so fresh is that they're not always available. But now that everything is available all the time, I don't know how that's going to work for them. I think we'll probably either see some appreciation lost for a lot of these older movies, or we'll see them launch with all these movies but take them off and slowly kind of walk back and cycle through stuff in the years to come.
So is everything on the service now? Because I can't imagine they would put like something like the Song of the South on there, right?
So they've omitted a few. So like Song of the South isn't on there. They have every animated feature except for Make Mine Music, which was one of the World War II like short film collection movies they did.
Right.
Which like they released some of the more dicier in terms of how they deal with race movies on Disney Plus. Like the original Dumbo is there in its original format. It took me literally an hour to find a movie that had something that I was like, that's pretty racist. Just watching Disney Plus the first day. So I'm curious to see what they'll do. And like, there's, you know, whole issue where they released this little disclaimer that's a tag at the bottom of the description of a lot of these older movies. It's like, yeah, this is a product of its time. It's released in its original format. And so it's also interesting to see how they'll handle other stuff like that, because I think with something like Song of the South, you have a weird responsibility with it, because obviously you don't want to promote that kind of racism, but I think it's also historically relevant just because we have to be able to see that, like, yeah, until a couple of decades ago, this was thought to be okay. And I think it's an interesting marker of society and how we use art or shouldn't use art. So I'm interested to see how they handle stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see kind of what the film preservation side of all this is, because I mean, they have so much stuff now, but they can kind of just pick and choose whatever they want and put it on there. So I don't really like this at all, but I'm very interested to see like what things are kind of forgotten and like what things they just kind of just don't do anything with. I mean, especially with like the Fox content they have, like maybe they just find no use in something and just like, we just forget about it and it just ceases to exist in like the minds of the general public, which is a scary thing. And then like, that's just like, it kind of goes against like kind of everything like the Criterion stands for and all that stuff. And just like, so it will be fascinating because like Disney is not very keen on just working with that kind of stuff. I mean, like you mentioned before, they have the vault where they kind of just like artificially like change like preserve film and like kind of what's like out there. So I am a little nervous in that sense because they might just find like, I don't really need this anymore. I don't need Alien 3. Let's get rid of this forever. No one needs to see this ever again or anything like that. I don't know. It's very interesting. I don't really know what to make of that part of it.
Yeah. And, you know, they've been a little bit light on the Fox content so far. So they have The Simpsons, which was a huge selling point. And they edited that, but that's TV. So I don't want to jump too far into that. But they have like Avatar and The Sound of Music. But they really don't have a ton of Fox content on there yet. So I'm interested to see how they'll handle that. And I'm sure a lot of it just is due in part to the fact that, you know, they didn't own Fox until earlier this year. And so there are definitely going to be different licensing agreements and streaming agreements with a lot of that content for a year or two to come.
Yeah, and they're trying to make Disney Plus pretty family friendly. So, I mean, I dropped Alien 3, but you're probably not going to see that ever on Disney Plus. That might be something for Hulu or something like that. And I think there's been a lot of news about what they've been trying to do with FX and maybe do like an FX channel on Hulu or something like that. So I wonder if maybe we're due for some type of crazy rebranding of Hulu, so that we'll see some of those things, some of the non like super Disney properties or kind of Disney-ish where it's just very family friendly. They might end up there. I don't know. I think there's definitely a few more shoes to drop, and then we're going to kind of see how things like Netflix and all these other people kind of respond to this. I know like Netflix released this week that they signed a new deal with Nickelodeon to kind of work on some new projects with like existing characters, Nickelodeon characters. So that's something else interesting that they're going to try to do there. There's a lot of moving parts here. But at first glance, it seems like Disney Plus is just very popular, but I feel like we kind of all expected that.
Yeah. And we're really early in the game to really be sure of what the impact of this is going to be. And I'm sure they're definitely keeping things out of public eye and ear right now, just with their future plans for it. But it's definitely going to be a monumental force in the market. Whatever that looks like, I'm sure it's going to continue to be a Disney property, which means it's going to make waves and basically own all of our lives in the year to come. So fun stuff.
Oh boy. Oh geez.
So with that pretty much wraps up this week in movie news, except for Joker crossed the $1 billion mark. It's the first R-rated movie to do so, and has been the first R-rated, or the highest grossing R-rated movie for several weeks now. But $1 billion is impressive, especially considering it didn't get a China release, which, to reach $1 billion without China is crazy, because they are typically the second largest market for movies like this.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, we've kind of talked the Joker to death in the past few weeks, but this is just, it's just kind of like a little extra cherry on top of all like the great news that's come out of this movie. it's just really solid financially, which is just crazy to think about how, like, kind of like the just the power of what brands have. Like, if Joker wasn't in this movie, like, and it was just some dude going insane, it's just like it's doesn't. Maybe it plays in a few indie theaters and it goes to some streaming service. Like, it's just that's just kind of the age we live in, where like they can just put a property on something and it makes $1 billion. It's yeah, it's really crazy. And it's, I mean, it's just a good job by Warner Brothers. It's like it's their big moneymaker of the fall so far. So it's yeah, it's just kind of just great financial news all around.
Yeah, I mean, go them. we've talked about the movie.
I guess. And, question mark.
We don't necessarily have the highest opinions of it, but I mean, it's a success. And while I don't think the movie is great just in terms of how it hits its subject matter, I do think it'll encourage more movies like it that'll hopefully have a little bit more depth. So I think overall, this is a pretty positive thing.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm actually very excited to see what Birds of Prey is when it comes out in February next year. Because that kind of looks like it's something in the mold of this, where it looks like Harley Quinn's breaking the fourth wall and all this stuff. And it looks very interesting and just very strange, which I think is really cool. So yeah, this, like you said, I definitely agree there, where it's not the greatest thing, but I do think this can do a lot of good for the kind of like big blockbuster-y movies that we see. So in that sense, I'm kind of happy.
Yeah, I'd say overall it's positive. So we'll applaud that. And yeah, that pretty much wraps up this weekend at the box office. Next week will be just as busy, really. We've got A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood with Tom Hanks. We've got 21 Bridges as well as Frozen 2. And depending on where you live, Knives Out, some early screenings. So there's plenty to talk about, and we'll be here walking through it all.